I want to talk about it for a few minutes. I want to talk about the sermon for a few minutes. I've had friends who didn't enjoy it. I went to a school where I had a teacher when I was in college who felt that the Sermon on the Mount wasn't for our age and we couldn't learn anything from it. Consequently, we never read it there at all. And I've always tried to speak respectfully of all my teachers, wanted to anyway. I wondered about the position. I used to argue over everything, but I didn't argue out of knowledge. I argued out of insolence and just the desire to argue. I hardly believe what an argumentative fellow I was for years. I got somewhat over it in the Army, and other things in life helped me too, but I argued over everything the teacher said, not because I had knowledge or information, but just because I thought that somebody I'd disagree with them, and I would disagree with them. The result was that in my college for Bible studies, I was an English major, but I took a lot of Bible courses. Never got much on the Sermon on the Mount. I began to read it, not devotedly, just occasionally, but it's easy, it's quick to read. And then I wondered, you know, why my teachers were so anxious to keep it out of this age, especially when I discovered a lot of it was in Luke too, some parts of Mark, you know, some aspects of John, and a good bit of it in the epistles, in different applications. So I came to feel in time that the Sermon on the Mount was an extremely meaningful passage there. Just like every other Bible portion, there are things in it we have to study and understand. We might not all understand them the same, things we have to explain, but I began to feel it was an enormously meaningful Bible portion. I also began to feel that sometimes people did not enjoy it because it really has a tendency to kick you in the ankle or someplace with a powerful kick. It is a painful section of your aims and ambitions. It's hard to say this just right, but your aims and ambitions are on yourself, or on your image, or on your self-will, on the good you can get, and the Sermon on the Mount is a powerful kick against that sort of thing. All these things the Lord tells us to do, like to pray, and fast, and all those things, but to do them secretly so that nobody knows by God. What is the glory in that? What's the glory in that? What is the good? I'm being sarcastic in a way. Do you understand that? You have to watch out for seminary students. But what is the good in giving great gifts if nobody knows that you gave it? Don't you give the gift so you'll be known as a generous giver? Or in fasting? In fasting. What's the value in fasting if nobody in the church gives you any credit for it? I'm smiling, you see, because you all are ahead of me on that, I suppose. But the truth is that the sermon cuts down every motivation from us except wanting to be like Jesus and honoring God. Well, it cuts down every motivation except that. And those are great spiritual motivations for us, but they don't appeal a lot to the flesh, and they don't have a lot of fleshly wisdom, a lot of fleshly pride. I had a friend in college. I'm sure he was a godly fellow, because it's easy to be critics later, but he was a concern for his family that wasn't saved. He would go out in the woods, and he would pray in the woods nightly for his family. He didn't tell you that he did that. He just prayed so loudly that you knew it. He didn't blow a trumpet in front of him. He had a voice like Mr. Harding's. He would go down in the woods and he would kneel behind an oak tree and he would pray. And I was very much impressed by that as a college student. Very much impressed that he would spend that much time in fervent, vigorous, loud prayer. Until I realized that the loudness of your voice doesn't reach heaven any better than the spirit of your heart does. And that his loud voice in the deep woods, without maybe his meaning it this way, but his loud voice in the deep woods was more for us and his reputation than it was for the salvation of his parents. It's easy to be judgmental. And the sermon says, before you start pulling those specks out of other people's eyes, be sure you get the big boards out of yours. But I was always struck by that. I was always struck by the sort of person who witnesses loudly when someone's around to hear him and sits and reads a book when nobody is around. There are such people. So the sermon takes away every reason to live and be apart from wanting to be like Jesus and doing the will of God. And it's very forceful in those lines. So it really goes against what in the flesh most of us want to be. So I've asked you to read it through once a week for the duration of the course. That's 10 times. It takes about 12 minutes if you're slow. If you're very slow, 20. If you have to go, 30. It's not a long section. I read beautifully. I can read it at breakfast before my tea gets warm enough in my cup to drink easily. I want you to read the commentary of Martin Lloyd-Jones. Beautiful devotional commentary with lots of truth and applications. If you haven't read it, maybe some of you have read it already. But if you haven't read it, then read it. If you've read it, browse it again. It's just a beautiful book of applications and spiritual truths. Again, I don't always agree with everything Boyd Jones says, but he doesn't say bad things. It's just differences of opinion. I enjoyed reading it very, very much. I'm asking you to read the commentary of Gulich. Gulich says some things I don't like. I didn't bring it with me. Some things that I think he's wrong on. So I suggest here that you'll need to read it in conjunction with the class progress in the study, because there are things in it we'll want to discuss, comment on, and critique. He also has a lot of material which is helpful, but it's interwoven with stuff that I would just as soon have there. But in terms of breadth of reading, it's a good breadth of reading, and it's not like something that's totally negative where you have to punch at it all the time. That's for all students. Now, that's everybody, all students, regardless of what you're doing. Now, for those who are working in Greek, I guess. Let's see. Yeah, for those who are working in Greek, yes, the background of Greek, that should be Mr. Choi, Mr. Garish, Mr. Hay, Mr. Lee, and Mr. Souther, when he gets back from selling airplanes in Taiwan. And know what Souther's doing, selling airplanes in Taiwan. If he doesn't have to fly all the way across the Pacific in one, he'll be for those who are working in Greek, I'll come to them in a few minutes. English Bible students, they prepare an analytical outline of the entire sermon.
An analytical outline.
When I was teaching English, you didn't have to say a word about it. You said analytical outline. Everybody said, yeah, yeah, sure. But since I'm not teaching English anymore, an analytical outline is one in which you really read the whole sermon. You determine what the major theme of it is. Your words might be different from somebody else's. You determine what the major theme of it is, and then you analyze the entire sermon, section by section, verse by verse, in the light of that theme. You show how that theme is developed out of the outline. Now you can outline first if you want, section by section, and see if a theme develops. I'm not telling you exactly what you have to put the cart horse first, but the analytical outline takes the whole sermon, breaks it down into minute points, shows how it works together to develop a common theme or a common teaching. And the beauty of an analytical outline is that you really have to look at a thing in intensity and depth. You can't just fly by. So English Bible students are required to prepare an analytical outline and to prepare three papers, not more than 5 pages in length each, that is, nor less than three, between 3 to 5 each. And they may select from this list of subjects 3 that they'd like to work on. The selection is up to them. English Bible students, the selection is up to them. 3 to 5 pages each, no more than 5, no less than 3. I wouldn't fight over one word, but 2 words is a violation of the contract. So 3 to 5, 3 papers on that. You select 3 and write the papers on them. You can retitle your work, but it's got to be in that area. If you decide to write on the casting pearls before swine, you might title the paper Gems Thrown to the Wicked World. But it's got to be over those passages on pearls before swine in chapter 7. So that's the thrust of it. That's the Sermon on the Mount. MDiv students, the Greek gang, MDiv students are expected to translate the entire sermon, the text of Matthew 5 through 7. Your translation, along with suitable exegetical notes, in which you show the appropriate parsings. If you come onto something like a conditional sentence, you tell what it is and what it means. Suitable exegetical notes will be due at the end of the quarter. Later on, we'll talk a lot about the sermon in class. We can't make much use of Greek in class because half of my students don't read Greek. And that's tough. But there are a lot of things we can do together that we'll work on. But that's what MDiv students are supposed to do. So all students have a paragraph at the top. They all do that. Then the English Bible students have certain things. Then the MDiv students have certain things. And Mr. Garish.
With reference to the text of Matthew 5 and 7 translation, not quite at the end of Jesus, you want any summary of the intersections?
No. Not unless you, if you want to do it, that would be fine. I'm not requiring it, though. The translation is a pretty big job. It's not really hard Greek, but there are some tough sections to it. As compared with Luke 1, there are no tough sections there. But as compared with 1 John, there are some tough sections. And in 1 John, as I recall it, there were some tough sections. Where is the easy Greek? Oh, John 15, John 17. There's the easy Greek. Yeah. Any other questions there? Mr. Hay.
What was that?
far as I'm concerned, Mr. Haig, any tool is convenient for you. Naturally, here's a dumb thing, it's for a teacher to say, naturally, I don't just want you to copy it on a lamb's head and say, well, he did it, so I like his work. That's a dumb thing to say. But I don't object to the use of reasonable tools. I don't object to the use of, I hate to say interlinears, but if you do the translation, I don't terribly object. We'll have an exam later on in which the only tool will be your head, the text.
Translation?
Oh, yeah, in the last exam. For the Greek students, yeah, I'll have some Greek things for them. But I don't mind the use of reasonable tools. I always had an analytical near my desk. I didn't often use it. But every now and then I'd come on some second Aristotle that I didn't know or some other form, and I never saw the point of beating my head against the wall on something I didn't know when there was a tool divided to give it to me.
For exegetical moods, we can use the more the pictures or the study.
Yes, if you'd like. Or Wiest, if you'd like. But don't go into too great a depth. I mean, I don't want a book on it. Translation with the exegetical notes, yeah. Yeah, I'm not trying to make that a giant assignment, but it compensates for what the English students are doing. The translation is beautiful and worthwhile. I've always felt that there was a greater point to get facility with the translation than to be than to do everything original all by yourself. So there are lots of helps today. There's the index and all of those things. But you know, the funny thing is, if you don't know Greek, those helps aren't much help after all. If you don't know Greek, you can read Zodiotes, and all you've learned is what Zodiotes says about it. You're not sure what it means. And then there are different levels of knowing Greek. There are people who know Greek like Wayne Davidson and Peterson and Dr. Newman. There are people like them. There are people who know Greek like myself and Ms. Tredick. There are people who work at those levels. So there are different excellences of Greek like there are of Hebrew and just about everything else. But the translation is good, and it's involves a fuller study. So feel free to use what tools are useful to you. I love little things like Chapman, for example. He often doesn't tell me enough, but I love them. And I didn't wear out the analytical either. I still got the analytical I bought in 1946. It looks a little used, not terribly used, but I've used it. Some of those forms, and of course some people when they learned Greek learned all the principal parts for all the verbs. If you do that, then the analytical is almost worthless. But if you didn't do that, or if you didn't learn all of the third declension genitives, if you didn't do that, then once in a while a word can really run up the wall.
So you're not asking the texture activities, but the more word study, the Greek words implies.
Well, I'm accepting that, but I'm asking for exegetical notes. Like if you observe, for example, a conditional sentence or something of that sort, that's significant. Not everyone are for that. I want the student to feel comfortable with it and to enjoy the sermon. You don't have to show me all the parsings, but I will give you a test at the end of the semester in which half of your test will be on the Greek text. Half of your test will be on the Greek text, and for that test, I may very well ask some parsings, and there will be no helps there but the head. That's right. For those who have studied Greek, the MDiv students, half the final exam will be Greek, or the Greek of the sermon. Half of it. And I'll clarify that later, just so you know what's coming. I don't expect you to memorize it, and I don't expect you to know everything, but I always try to find the things I don't know and ask them on the test. And if the students ask them correctly, I add that to the syllabus next year. Any other questions there? Mr. Farrell. I want to type double spaced. I want it in good order. Obviously, you don't need a bibliography. And you may not need any footnotes. But if you do have footnotes, I want them in the right form. Whether you're using Turabian or the New York Library System, it doesn't make a lot of difference to me. But I want them in good form. Any other questions there? Those are short papers. Don't, if you have that many footnotes, your paper will grow. So don't, that 3 to 5 pages, that's not 18 pages, half of which are footnotes. 3 to 5 pages all together. You obviously don't need a bibliography unless something like that. Any other questions? Mid-semester examination will be March 31st. My, that is early. That's early. Maybe that'll prove too early. That's where I've set it for. You have to set an exam date. If it looks too early, next week we'll look and see if we can alter it. but thought that might be reasonable. March 31st. That's not a Friday. Is it? What day is it? What day is March 31st?
Friday.
Is it a Friday? Is that Good Friday? Oh, okay. Well, we'll look at it next week. If it looks like it's an impossible date, we can move that. But you have to set one down. If you set one down, then you've got something to work with. Any other questions there? Good. Final exam will be cumulative. Exams are one quarter each. Papers together are one quarter. Greek work is one quarter. See, the papers are for the English types and the Greek work for the Greek types. Class preparedness and preparation, one quarter. That's hard to evaluate, but I will call on you a lot in this class. I'm not going to lecture a lot. I will for the first couple hours, but after that I will call on you a lot. And sometimes I don't know, sometimes you don't know, but what we'll do mostly after we get done with some introductory material, what we'll do mostly is talk about the sermon, what it means, what it says, how it's used. And I will expect you to be ready to help me on that as much as you can. So those are basic instructions. Then the progress of the course is given over on the second of these pages, the progress of the course. Today you're suffering through the introductory data. I may in a little while show you some of my inductive charts. I may not. I have to think about that. I've got them here, but I have to think about that. For the Friday class, be sure you have read and understand the introduction in Gulick. Don't take it for granted. Be sure you read it and understand it, because again, I want to ask you some pointed things on it, make some observations. And we will move, you can see how we go through the rest of the period, all the way down to May the 12th, when the course will end, happily for all, no doubt. And you'll forgive me for misspelling Beatitudes almost every time. I just have never been able to get over that. As many times as I've tried, it keeps reaching up to haunt me out of the grave, as it were. But it's not the worst thing you can do. It's one of the worst things you can do. I have here, then, a couple more pages. Are there no questions there?
I have a couple more pages to distribute. I don't really have a syllabus for this course. I have 10 pages of introductory stuff in general. These are the first two of them. Beyond that, we're off the blackboard and we'll look at it tomorrow. So I don't really have a syllabus, but I think I've pages for Dr. Chairman, which I should have prepared for. All the many things I should have done did do this tomorrow. There's a huge things I should have done. Not the efficient way to pass out papers. I don't want to do it like this. In the efficient way, we get time.
So let me discuss some of these things with you for a few minutes. Some of it is self-evident, and you know it without my going into it, but I want to mention it. Skeletal facts in our discussion, the place of the sermon in the Lord's ministry. Now, the Lord Jesus taught for about 3 years. About 3 years. There's an argument over whether it was 3 years, 2.5, 3.5. I opt for the 3 years, just over 3 years. But do you know, you can teach an awful lot of material in 3 years with any kind of dedication, and the Lord certainly had an enormous amount of dedication. In my own life, in 3 years, I preached at least 900 sermons. That's the way it's gone for a good while. I meet a number of these classes, sometimes wretchedly and various other things, and yet I waste a lot of time, though. We won't discuss what I do. I'm conscious of it, I try to resolve it. All I'm saying is that in 3 years you can do an awful lot. And the Lord taught in 3 years. And here we've got the four Gospels, which are awfully little books. If anyone dared to think that all of Jesus' taught was included in those Gospels, we would turn him to the last chapter of John, where John says the world couldn't contain all the books. The Lord did so much. So it seems reasonable that the the important, let's drop the word important. It seems reasonable that the most necessary aspects of his teaching would be repeated again and again and again, and it is. The Sermon on the Mount stands like a kernel, of which large segments of it are repeated in Luke, some concepts are given in Mark, and there's a little overlap in John. Not so much in John, because half of John, just about, is passion discourse, and that's a different game too. The Passion Week and the Sermon on the Mount together occupy the great bulk of the teaching of the New Testament. So when we say, what is the place of the sermon in the Lord's ministry, I'm prone to say that it probably is the very center of his ministry and capsulize a great mass of the other teaching. I have a friend who said, well, if that were true, he said, there's no presentation of the gospel in the Sermon on the Mount, the saving gospel. And I've always responded to that. You're an adult class, so I can respond to you adult-like. But I've always responded to that by beginning to sing the little chorus, the wise man built his house upon the rock, which, as you know, comes in the Sermon on the Mount. And in that particular section of Matthew, which really wraps up the sermon altogether, the Lord says, it isn't the people who tell me what great things they've done to go to heaven, but those that have done the will of my Father. And the will of his Father is not stated there in just so many words, but it introduces you to the truth of how people are saved. They're saved by doing the will of God, which in John 6 is believing on the one whom God has sent, and many, many other things. So when someone says, well, there's no clear statement of the Sermon on the Mount, it would be hard to have a clearer statement than those verses in the end of Matthew 7. Because they emphasize the reality that salvation is a matter of God's will in us, a will attained through faith in Jesus Christ, through expressing faith in Jesus. I have friends that don't think the Lord, got all these critical friends. They are even suspicious of John 3, because the Lord doesn't explain in great detail how the new birth is achieved. You would think that what he says in John 3:16, other verses, would be enough for the average person. But some people are never really satisfied. The Lord would have written a book on theology and use several German terms that make it really click with that. But in the nature of the Sermon on the Mount, everything is put in dependence on Jesus. It's those who seek righteousness that are right. It's those who do his will that are right. It's those who pray and forgive that are right. So I've tried to say that the Sermon on the Mount is the very central feature of the ministry of Jesus. And his teaching revolves around it in a powerful sort of sense. It epitomizes what I refer to as figure B, the concept of the king and his subjects. Matthew is certainly the gospel of the kingdom, meaning by that the gospel to show Jesus as king of the Jews. Certainly Matthew is that. So the Sermon on the Mount is a great Solomonic picture of the king with his subjects, telling them their privileges in his kingdom, what their responsibilities are, and what he expects of them. And I've always just been kind of thrilled by that. I love the way it opens. He took them up into a mountain. When he had sat down, he opened his mouth and talked. The king expressing truth to his subjects. It's organized around 6 points, as I see it, the organizational ideal, built around 6 points. The Beatitudes, when spelled correctly, which talk about the quality of life. We'll look at them pretty long here one of these days, the quality of life. The Antitheses, the place where action that is right, not just expedient. We get into a whole circumstance in life of thinking only expediently. I'm not free from that. But the Lord tries to put the action in life on the basis of what is right, and not either what is thought to work or what has been expedient through the years. And then all of chapter 6 is wrapped up with the practice of spiritual exercise. The chapters tie into those things. So the sermon is built around those hubs. The quality of life that ought to be ours, the action of life that ought to typify us, the conduct in life that ought to show we understand what values and practical things really are, what they really are. We had a student at Faith Seminary years ago. My wife and I had lived in a barn in the town of Hatboro for about 2.5 years plus. It was slightly reconditioned, but it was cheap. So we lived there and saved money to get the down payment on a house. Which wasn't so much then, but it also just didn't go out and pick up off the ground. We lived in a slightly reconditioned barn for about 2.5 years. It was cheap. And then we had saved enough money, and the providence of God, we were able to buy a house, which was also cheap, but we were able to start buying. We had a down payment saved. And so as we moved out of the barn, one of the students in the seminary that we knew quite well. See, at that time, I was not much older than the seminarians. Now, I'm older than a lot of the fathers, but at that time, I was not much older. So there was a student that we knew well. They had four or five children like us, and like we did. So they were looking for an economical place, and they said, could we refer them to the owner of the barn? We referred them to the owner of the barn. He was delighted to have more of the seminary people. He was poor as we were. He was delighted to have people who pay him regularly, even though it was small, and lived there. So they moved in. Well, one afternoon in the spring, my wife saw a cloud of smoke at the other end of the capital, heard the fire whistles, and they were called and said, the barn's on fire. My wife feared that these people were wandering. She dashed out madly to see what was happening. And see, she thought that the husband of work nights was sleeping there, and no one would know it. When they said his car was gone, that didn't mean she knew that his wife might be shot, so she dashed out madly. But by the time she got up there, everybody was out. And somebody said that they saved anything. They really didn't save anything. I mean, a flesh of the sort. They didn't really save anything. The fire had gathered quickly in the basement, had gotten into a wood bin before anybody knew it. It completely inflamed the lower level before, when the little boy decided to go down to the basement, came back and said to his daddy who was sleeping, he said, I think we ought to leave this place. When his father brought him and said, why? He said, there's a lot of smoke out there. His father went out, and the kitchen was filled with smoke. He grabbed the two babies and fled. The other family members had gone to the store. He grabbed them and he fled. He did not so much as dress himself very properly. He fled in his shorts, which may not be appropriate, but he fled. The place was imminent. In a matter of another few minutes, it was confirmed. So someone said to him, some lad said, well, when you were fleeing the bar, what was the most important thing you wanted to say? That's how you set your values. What was the most important thing? And he said, I'm not sure what the most important thing is, but he said, the things I wanted to say were my babies and myself. Someone said, oh, you didn't. They thought it was criminal. He didn't want to get his Bible. But I kind of chuckled at that. They then lived with us for 5 weeks till they found another place. People poured in clothes on them. They were better dressed than they'd ever been dressed in their lives. We chuckled one night. They had a little girl about the age of Mike Jenny, and they were just put on, they just tried on some clothes. This little girl said to Mike Jenny, she said, isn't this fun? She said, as soon as we get everything we need, she said, we'll burn your house down and you can live with us. But we didn't think that was the way we wanted to go. But people get so attached to material things, and the concept in the sermon is that there is a spiritual exercise, godly conduct, not the rules. And you can't say, well, a guy didn't take his Bible, it must not be very important to him. There are relative areas of importance and scope, especially in a land where you can quickly buy a Bible, I suppose. But it's amazing how we get attached to things in terms of what they are rather than in terms of what they mean spiritually. So the sermon is organized around those things, warning us to live practically, enormously practical material, warning us to live in a loving relationship with one another, learning us how to forgive, warning us against the easy belief idea that so easily penetrates our world, warning us about just doing things that God is pleased with us, and finally concluding the saying, oh, be complete like your Father in heaven is complete. And some have said, well, nobody can be that way. Well, are you all awake yet? See, nobody can get that way, but you know as a believer, we are that way. And so the Lord is telling us at the end of Matthew, that we ought to learn to live, as the end of Matthew 5. Okay, so we ought to learn to live in the light of what God has given us and the life that He's invested in us. We learn to do that, it would make a huge difference for us. So that's the organization ideal of the sermon. It's built around those things, and those are enormously practical things. They touch on the life of the church everywhere you look. Everything from prayer, fasting, giving, to testing false prophets, to determining what's wrong, to seeing how life is built, seeing how your testimony goes, all of those things, everything from being a light set upon a hill to being a house built upon whatever has to be built. I offer a kind of a short order outline at the bottom of page one of the sermon. Short order outline with regard to the Lord's people. I won't go over the detail, that's why it's there. And the tests of honest performance, and the matter of maturing spiritually, and the matter of walking openly, and finally the concluding warning. You could no doubt write a better outline than that. Your analytical outlines will be better, the English fellows, but you could no doubt write a better outline than that. But what I've said in Bible study is the important thing is that you have some concept of outline some concept of understanding the material. I taught Old Testament survey last quarter, and I said that I wanted everybody to know, a comprehensive outline for every book of more than 8 chapters in the Old Testament, with the exception of the Book of Psalms. That's a different story. More than 8 chapters, I said you should know a comprehensive outline. So I asked them to test a comprehensive outline for one of the prophetic books. That's about 66 chapters. Guess what that one is? The comprehensive outline of the exam,
for which I gave no credit whatsoever,
was one, condemnation of sins in particular, chapters 1 through 35. Two, condemnations of sins in general, chapters 36 through 6. I looked at it. Scratched my head. I felt like a failure as a teacher right there. Felt like maybe I should just go and resign instead of waiting to retire. I should just walk into Putnam's office and say, I'm Don Putnam. But after a while, I'm very good at this. After a while, I quit blaming myself and blamed the student, you know. Didn't comprehend. But I thought, in a way, there was a certain ingenuity in that. But, you know, after I got done feeling irritated, then I began to chuckle. And by that time, I had just decided not to give any credit and let it go with that. I didn't even write a snide note. But here's a short outline of the Sermon on the Mount. It's easily within the framework of Matthew. And I'm not saying you need to know that, but that's what I suggest to you. Now, the concluding warning section I've already talked about a little bit. Really important. Now, capital C on page 2, the general content, the intended audience. Well, what do you think? What do you think? He sat down and taught them. Now, the disciples came and gathered around him. So it seems obvious that the intended audience was immediately in the Matthew passage and the Luke passage. Why? Because I think the Lord taught these things many times. You know, I'm guessing, because I have no proof. My guess is he probably went over the form of prayer dozens of times. Students do not hear you well the first time. And I've always been a pretty good student, but I often did not hear my teachers well the first time. Once in a while I did, but often didn't. Often I had to get them to repeat themselves endlessly, and if they hadn't, so my guess is that the Lord went over these things many, many times for the edification and strength of those disciples. That's my guess. And so in that particular connection, the intended audience was, first of all, the immediate company of disciples who gathered around him, who would be apostles later on. And then beyond them, such of the multitude that had been down in the plain might have come up the mountain to hear. Now, the Lord didn't have armed guards out there with submachine guns to keep the crowds away. But I think the initial intended audience were the disciples who would hear the Lord. And then beyond them, those who would come. And beyond that, all the church in the later ages. Because these are the words of the intimate leader given to the intimate audience. And it would be hard to believe they were not to be heard by all of his people. Mr. Gerrish.
Do you think that because Matthew wasn't written in chapters, the verse 25 might be
what do you think?
Sir?
Yes, I would say so. You mean of chapter 4? Yes, I would think so. It pulls that together. That's why I broadened the circle or moved the circle out. Yeah. Someone said to me once, if Jesus were sitting down, he sat down, you know, on a day, he sat down, how far could his teaching go? Well, that depends on a lot of things. The Lord certainly did not have a whiny, insignificant voice. And we're told at the end how he taught with authority, not like the scribes. And it's easy to imagine authority being a Harding-type voice. That's easy to imagine. Or at least an emphatic, clear voice. So he's no doubt in a Dell kind of an area. He no doubt has the benefit of background. He's got a strong voice. My guess is they were absolutely quiet. I guess he could have taught several hundred those. Or, you know, spoken about that. So I think that's right. I think Matthew 4 does lap over in giving us the definition of that. The character of the warnings are along two lines. The one in chapter 7, to believe, and that's also true with the straight way, goes just before that. The character of the warning chapter 7, to believe,
and the character of warnings in chapter 6 not to be like the hypocrites and the pretended religious peoples round about.
What the warnings was expected from the sermon? Did they have someone not correspond to their expectations, or it was just the opposite?
I don't know exactly, but I kind of think that as far as his own were concerned, it corresponded to their expectations well. I don't know about the multitude. It seems that the multitude was never happy with Jesus' expositions unless he also gave them meaning.
Basically, the sermon stated as the picture of all the human religions
for self-gaze. That's always possible. You know, there are two factors there. Sometimes when you remove what people think they ought to get or have, sometimes that relieves them of great feelings of responsibility, guilt, and need. And sometimes it relieves them of other motivations too. So I don't know. But I'm sure the disciples were pleased. That's just my imagination.
Because in chapter 7, verse 8, the people
Yeah, the people as a group, he taught them like one who had authority, not like the scribes. And that may well have included the disciples too. The disciples had a lot to learn. But I think the thrust on the people at the end of chapter 7 gives that wider range to the audience. I wouldn't be surprised what the disciples were surprised in a way, but I'd be amazed if they were disappointed. You do see indications from time to time, like in Luke when Peter says, "We've left all and followed you." The implication is, what do we get out of that? Purely natural thing, though. But every now and then you do see a touch like that. And of course, in a setting like this in Matthew, that would be an unthinkable kind of question. Yes, thank you. Any comments or observations? I'm open to them. Remember that. Now, the character of the warnings, as I said, with regard to belief and being like the hypocrites. The year after I was converted, I went with some people to a meeting where the preacher was one of these very loud, very emotive, jumped all over the platform, slapped his head, slapped his knee, held up his foot. Unbelievable. But I will tell you something. He was fluent and vocal, and he bounced around that platform and hammered out the truths. And when the meeting was over, this was in a mission in Pittsburgh, when the meeting was over, about 20 drunks staggered forth and said they wanted to be saved. I must say, as we drove home that night, I said to myself, that's how I'd like to speak. Because I wrongly equated the form of delivery with the result of the message. And maybe those drunks, who knows, but anyhow, it took some action on their part. It didn't go. So I found myself wanting to be like people for particular success reasons. And I'm sure in the old gospel age it was very much that way too. And the Lord says, don't be like the hypocrites. Don't be like the Pharisees. They have their reward, but don't be like them. Even though they've got the reputation and they're successful, don't be like that. And you can see that theme running through the sermon repeatedly. Don't be like the people who take the law and use it just for their own good. Don't be. Omissions, the general content of omissions. I think it would be not good for me to talk much about omissions in the Sermon on the Mount. But there are some things that you wish the Lord said a little more about, like the new birth. You're allowed to wish that. You're not allowed to be nasty about it or critical, but you might wish the Lord said a little more about the new birth. You might wish the Lord had explained something about the church. He doesn't, in any visible, palpable way. There are a number of teachings that you might wish he had explained, but I would say there are no real omissions. There are just those points that you wish were enhanced. And so I had this friend, still have him, I think. I said, I wish the Lord had given us 20 more chapters, two or three more chapters on the church, how it ought to be organized, all that kind of stuff. And he looked at me and he said, why?
He said, I already know 20 things the scripture tell you to do that you're not doing. Why do you want more not to do? The kind of friends I get. Why do you want more not to do? I was sorry I didn't mention it to him. And in a way, of course, he was right. But in a way, I hope he was also somewhat wrong. But in a way, he was probably right. So it would be folly for me to go back and say the Lord should have said more, but you can't help but wish that he had. Like on the fasting business. He tells us when you fast. He doesn't tell us when to fast or why, but he says when you do it, rub a little extra oil on yourself, look good, don't stand around, because you're to fast before God, not before men. Well, wouldn't a couple of other verses on when you should fast, if you should indeed, wouldn't a couple of other verses, or maybe he could have just added a verse and said, but fasting was the Old Testament age, don't do it anymore. But we live without those things. So we study the Word, and we let the Spirit apply it, and we watch very carefully about being judgmental on others who might not see it as clearly as we do. I've been very fond of working with inductive outlines over the years. Inductive outlines are kind of tough, and inductive outlines and analytical charts often go kind of right together. They kind of go side by side. I have a whole series of them here that don't always make my point. They always help my students to know that I'm thinking about them. But here's an analytical inductive outline. This is not the whole sermon. This is just based on Matthew 5, 1 through 20. And I perceive that no overhead projector in the world, unless battery power, has ever worked well if it wasn't plugged in. You notice that the boys who are doing all the repair went to all these rooms and put in these three-prong sockets in the wall for us. So you can plug stuff in without even breaking off. Yeah, it may not work now. Analytical inductive outline along those lines. I'll just scoot this baby over an inch or so like this. Being careful not to break Mr. Hague's recorder in the process. Not terribly clear, but in a room like this you can see it. It's not thoroughly analytical, but it takes the concept that he sat down, yoked his mouth, and he taught them the truth. In Matthew 5, 1 through 20, the truth concerning the character of God's people, what their state is, what their condition is, what their promise is. If this were done in a fully inductive way, it would become a number of cross lines pulling things together. If it were done analytically, it would become a number of summary sentences. So it largely is an outline designed for me to help me get a grip of what I think the content in that is. And so I see their characteristics in verses 3 through 12, how they're blessed, how they're useful, how they're taught. I see what their condition ought to be when they are blessed, when they are being well used, when they are taught, and promise that's given to them of what will come to them, what it means to them, worked out finally in the long run. Now, the idea in an inductive outline is to recreate the text in minimal form within the framework of your notes itself. And that's essentially what you have. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Their promise is such. Their condition of mourning, their promise is such. Condition of meekness, their promise is such, and so forth and so forth. And when they are useful, when they're acting like salt, and when they're lighting, and when they're honoring God, and they're well taught, when they take His word and keep it and do it, rather than what the Pharisees do. This is not, I said about free thought, it's not analytical strictly, and not, what's the other word I had? Not analytical? Well, whatever it was. Neither one of those exactly, but it says to me, here's the concept that you're going to pick up in these 20 verses. Going to learn what the Lord's people are like and how they are useful and how they perform when they are well taught. So you've got a real quick picture of the Lord's people and their structure as to what they are and to what they ought to be like. And I kind of enjoy that sort of thing. Looking through, reading the verses, seeing what the common bonds are and bringing them back together. But I have a lot of those. I will give you a set of them later on, which will seem incomprehensible, I suppose. But don't tell me until after the course is over. Write it on your critiques when the course is over. Because I love to outline and work on those things. What I'm trying to say is, students ought not to copy teachers' outlines. Students ought to develop their own. Their own line should be broader than two general points telling you what kind of sins occur in different parts of Isaiah. They ought to be better than that. But students ought to work to develop their own, because the outline you develop, it won't be terribly different than
mine or dozens of others, but the outline you develop is the one you can work with and the one who will bless you and the one who will let you teach others. And that's the way it is in every kind of situation. Well, I will stop. We will meet on Friday, isn't it? Friday, we'll talk about the problem of interpretation a little bit, and we'll plunge on ahead into its background and other aspects of the Old Testament. New Testament.
We have books.
The books are in the bookstore if you want to buy them. With the exception of Watson, oh, I don't even ask Watson, but the articles are in there.
I'll say you want to take a second.
Yes, yes, I bet. I'll give you a whole setup. I've got them for the whole set. Yes, I saw your name.
Can I speak on a class?
Well, if you're reasonable and kind.
Is it all right?
Yeah, as long as you're reasonable and kind.